You're listening to the Music Manumit podcast for February 13th, 2011. Learn more at musicmanumit.com.
Hi, and welcome to another Music Manumit. I'm Tom, and as usual, with me is Doug.
Hey, guys and gals.
We have a guest today. We have Mr. Paul Jones from iBiblio, and he's here with us today. Say hi to the ladies and gentlemen there, Mr. Paul.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and Tom and Doug. I'm glad to be here.
I like that we're separate from that entire category.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a gentleman, so.
So
we're ruffians, Tom, ruffians.
Yes, we are. So you're from iBiblio. First of all, where's iBiblio located? Tell us a little about the origins of where it came from.
Okay, so those are about three or four questions in a row.
Yeah, they kind of were. Biblio,
so let me start back and say, what is iBiblio? It's one of the largest collections of collections on the internet. It's a host to and support for a large number of open source projects, as that's where we started, but about 2,500 projects that are not necessarily related to open source at all. Among those that you've probably heard of is Project Gutenberg, eTree, the legal music sharing site, Grok Law, which you need to know about if you care about open source and law, confluence.org, which is a project to document the confluence of every full degree latitude and longitude on dry land on Earth. And then there are smaller things, which are dark clubs, Tibetan groups that are helping out immigrants with AIDS, some documentation about Burma or Myanmar done by different journalists and so forth. So about eight radio stations, because we did invent streaming radio. So now back to where it all came from.
So is that like an Al Gore invent streaming radio, or did you really invent streaming radio?
I think you should look it up on the highest possible authority, Wikipedia.
Okay.
And you'll see that we did. The first radio signal, and it's still on the air now, was WXYC at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we actually had
I'm sorry, I forgot his name. The person who
Michael Schaffner.
There you go.
Might not.
Yeah, he's actually the one that told us that we should talk to you because we got to talking about your first streaming radio station and we were pretty impressed with the whole concept of it. And I even had a couple of questions in general, which we'll get to later. I just wanted to make that
okay,
note.
Well, technically it's kind of amusing, but because we did something not unlike what we're doing now. We took what was supposed to be a point-to-point chat program that had a little hub or repeater system to it called CUCME out of Cornell, and we put the radio signal on it and turned it, the audio, so it could only work one way.
Oh, okay.
It was so simple.
Yeah.
No kidding. But we were accused. It took us months to get it by the lawyers. And then when that happened, people in the IETF were convinced that we were going to destroy the internet by putting radio on it. Because everybody knows audio is too much for the radio.
Yes.
Or the internet to bear.
And this is obviously before YouTube and all that other stuff, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. This would lead to other things that would destroy the internet as we knew it.
You were the marijuana of the internet.
I could dig up the emails. They're funny and very panicky.
Yeah, really?
If you saw minuscule amount of bandwidth that we were using as a percent, it was hilarious. Plus, don't forget, I'm dealing with engineers who invented the M-bone, and that was really their problem, is that the M-bone was built for all these anticipated problems, and then we completely ignored them and just did it anyway, and it worked just fine.
Nice.
So I have a question about the lawyers. So were they concerned about, you know, the radio station has paid their licensing fees and those licensing fees would not be covered over the internet? Was that the lawyer's concern?
Well, it was multiple like that. Like, what happened if you broadcast outside your area? Could you be fined? Because we were using a college radio station, which is under that's a very specific license. That, interestingly enough, though, that very specific license allowed us to do exactly what we wanted to do. So originally, college radio wasn't, some of it wasn't even over the air. It was carrier current stations. Do y'all know what I'm talking about?
Are you talking like shortwave? Or
no, talking about running it on the electrics system within a building.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, in 1968, when I went to NC State, there was a student station. The only way you could pick up that student station was to plug your radio. You couldn't hear it on a portable radio or a car radio. You could only hear it by plugging your radio into the electric system.
Oh, that's so cool. No, I've never heard of that.
And so you could broadcast within the dorms. It's a really cool way. And I went to the lawyers and they said, what are you broadcasting over? And I said, wires, just like carrier current. And they went, really? Because that's authorized. And I went, sure. And they went, not only that, the licensing was fine. And they said, well, as long as it's not over air and you're not interfering with anybody else's signal, that's perfectly fine.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
And Carl Malma did something very similar when he got to work with NPR to put a microphone on both the Senate and the House. Major podiums and broadcast them live continuously on the internet. And when he filled out his application to be an NPR station, he tried to figure out what his frequency was. So he finally put some sort of ohm meter beside his internet repeater and picked up some sort of signal off the wire enough that he could put down some frequency.
Wow.
But it really, what you hear in all this is just the confusion that people had about transmitting over wire to multiple places. So that's kind of it. So where iBiblia started really was a grant from Sun Microsystems.
Really?
In 1992. So in fact, Halloween of 1992 is when we celebrate, if we say we began. Where there was a pre-Sunsite Life, which was a online bulletin board that let people sign up, and you could send email, and you could read the news services on the Usenet anonymously, which was, you know, kind of handy for some people, because, you know, you might not want everybody in the world knowing that you're reading some of the news groups, so there's a little protection there. And then some campuses or some didn't carry Usenet news, so other people could get to it that way. Our real idea, our proposal to Sun, was to look not only to distribute open source software, which we'd already been doing, and they wanted to support, but also to look at new technologies for what was then called information discovery and retrieval. And that included things like Gopher and things named like Gopher, Veronica, Archie, and of course the World Wide Web.
So do you mean search engines pretty much? Or
sort of. Don't forget the Gopher itself was sort of a hierarchical set of links that you could create for yourself, and then you could originally get a document or a picture.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it, or an audio file under certain sources. Another thing called Waze, Widely Information Services, which was invented by Brewster Kahle, who runs archive.org now, was a distributed database that let you have a system in which you could do searches across a whole bunch of different databases, and they would aggregate the returns. And those returns could be text or audio or pictures.
Okay.
Or you could do little movie files too, but I mean, so don't forget there wasn't a formatted return
right
at that time.
Yeah.
HTML is an invention, perhaps in its beginning a very bad invention by Tim Berners-Lee, but at least it was rudimentary and it looked better than the other things that I just described.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so you were actually involved with the guy from archive.org is what you were saying from that.
Oh yeah. In particular, Jim Fulton, who worked with us, was a developer for Waze, and then later Kevin Gamil and Nassim Nassar and other people participated in that kind of work. So ironically, Jim Fulton lives in Geneva and works for the World Intellectual Property Organization.
What's that?
WIPO?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one.
They coordinate all of the copyright and patent laws around the world.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So the copyright laws that you operate that affect you on the internet are directly discussed, coordinated, and implemented. Well, they're implemented by local jurisdictions, but WIPO tries to synchronize all of those laws in some way.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So rolling back, we also were in touch with a guy in Switzerland, Tim Berners-Lee, who was looking for a way to integrate all of these different kind of search protocols and then format the results in some way that made sense. And his World Wide Web was there. So he came by and on his way to give a poster in San Antonio at Hypertext 91 and set up a World Wide Web server, which you could only view. The only clients worked on Next computers.
Really?
Which is
the pre-app. That's what Steve Jobs made during his time away from Apple.
Right.
Right.
I had one, so I could surf the World Wide Web, all about 12 sites, maybe less than 12.
I just love the fact too, like when you said the hypertext gathering 1991 is, it's just like I hadn't even discovered the internet for like 5 more years by that time. I had no clue that this stuff was going on, and let alone that I'd even be involved in using it day to day and doing things. So it's just,
well, you know, most of my students weren't born, you know,
right? Yeah. So. And most kids didn't realize that there wasn't one, you know.
Right, exactly.
And then, well, it's actually still fairly new.
I'm happy for them in so many ways.
Yeah.
Because a lot of what we did was incredibly exciting, but also, now that I look at it, incredibly stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, and even things like podcasting and streaming music is only probably about 5 years old, you know, if that. And it's just so it's yeah. It's,
well, in the way that we know it now, yeah, that's
very true. That, yeah, in the way where it's commonplace to where people know what the heck you're talking about when you say it. Or
Carl Malma did probably the first version of this, and he did it with sponsors.
Really?
He did a show called Geek of the Week, and every week he would interview somebody and record it as a .au file, which is 8-bit audio. And you could download it from any FTP site, and then you could play it on your Sun workstation.
Nice.
And it played on a few others. And he interviewed Vint Cerf and Brewster, and I think he got Conn and Marshall Rose, who did a lot of the email protocols. It was extremely geeky. And
no, not at all. Doesn't sound like it.
Carl's best pitch when he went to Sun is they went, "How many people listen to this?" And he said, "Only the ones who are smart enough to appreciate your ads, because they have to have Sun workstation and they have to know who these people are." And Sun signed on right away. I mean,
wow,
I don't
cool.
think that's part of business now, but it was a smart move at the time.
Well, wow, that's a lot of really interesting history. That's really great. Now talking more about, I mean, even to go more into history about our biblio,
right?
what are some of, you mentioned a few of the projects that it, have basically come out of iBiblio. What are some of the most famous ones out of iBiblio itself that you could tell us about a little bit about?
Well, I think the most famous ones that you know that we've been hosting for a long time, of course, is Gutenberg. And that started long, long before much of anything else. I mean, you know, and that's part of the magic and wonder of Gutenberg, is that Michael Hart has been able to, you know, like stick with it and keep everybody involved and keep that vision just right on target. You know, the technological innovations are very cool, but the idea of being able to maintain, you know, some sort of vision for, you know, a nonprofit distribution of a text archive to all the world is pretty incredible. And, you know, a vision that influenced people like Jimmy Wales and others that are doing this kind of, or possibly Brewster even, not-for-profit change. And the miracle of Gutenberg, even though it goes back to the late 80s, is that its largest download days were this Christmas, because everybody who got their new Kindles or other readers were all downloading free text.
Right.
Of all these classical books from Project Gutenberg.
That it didn't even occur to me. Yeah, so it's kind of come full circle in the sense where all of a sudden it was like all this information's online, but now it's like, okay, now you can actually read it as a textbook because of the Kindle. That never occurred to me. That's actually really cool. I'm looking
it
at some...
It's pretty amazing to me that text that people typed in,
yeah,
you know, 25 years ago...
I'm actually looking
into Latin mode terminal windows.
Yeah. So the Kindle actually is hooked up to the iBiblio project, or I mean,
no, but you can, of course, have it go online.
Oh, that's right.
So they make it easy for you to download from Gutenberg.
Okay. Yeah, I'm actually looking at some of the Gutenberg, like the tree directory for the documents, and I'm looking at stuff going all the way back to. Yeah, 2003 even. I'm seeing here you got something from...
Oh, and there's stuff much older than 2003.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, in the 80s, Tom.
Really? Okay, well then I'm not looking down the right parent directory because I thought I clicked
they
through
may
the earlier
ones. It's been moved a few times.
So okay.
Probably. But if you look at the date within the files, that's where you'll see it. So.
There's another good question, too. I mean, what has the... what has the server kind of been like over the years for this? I mean, how have you been keeping all this information? And I mean, you say it's been moved a few times, but what's it like to keep
more
this
than
up?
Once. We're in constant, like any data center, we're in constant move and recording and re-looking at it. So do you guys actually want to talk about hardware infrastructure? I mean, that's
maybe not so much. I guess I realized when I asked it. I mean, it's I'd kind of like to know, but maybe other people
might
not.
Being out in the wrong direction.
Well, one thing that I think would be interesting is talking about the move from SunSite to MetaLab and now iBiblio and some of the reasons for that, for those two moves. I mean, those weren't physical server moves, or they're
political moves, really, in naming.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
The easy thing there is we originally ran a service called Launchpad, which would launch people onto the internet up until 92. And that was part of what helped us with our relationship, start our relationship with Sun, because we were already pretty well known. We were a very well known free software site already. And from there, Sun Microsystems responded, asked me to basically bid or fill out an RFP, respond to an RFP for free software distribution. And we did that and then entered a partnership with Sun that lasted about 8 years. Part of that deal was we would be named SunSite. So we were. Site, and Site stood for something like interesting technology and other stuff or something. I forget.
Really?
What
SITE was
for.
An acronym?
SITE. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. I like that.
And nobody remembers what in the hell it was, but then they made a great sort of slogan, which was sharing the wealth of knowledge, which was very nice. And then we did a lot of non-copyright stuff. So we had lots and lots of government information. And in fact, worked with the Clinton administration, which was very good about that, but putting all kinds of public domain documents online. And that process was duplicated in 40 some other sites before they ended the SunSite program. So we did that for about 8 years. And then Sun said, changed the relationship to that we would have to apply every year and do some sort of rejustification. And I wanted to do some fundraising that was a little more ongoing and that would give us a little, wouldn't let us be just at the whim of Sun. We love them as a sponsor, but we just couldn't have them be the sole one and have them coming and going on us. So we became MetaLab for that period. And at the same time, a company that we'd helped start, we distributed their first Linux release when they were going from CD to online. And in fact, when they came by and asked us about doing it, they were about four people. They were four people. And they said, we want to distribute this, all of our software in a bigger bundle than anybody else has done. And I went, okay, well, you have to buy a hard disk. And they took the president's Visa card and bought us a hard disk. And by the time that we'd were broadening our relationship or changing our relationship with Sun, they were about to IPO. They were Red Hat Linux, which you've probably heard of, which is about an $8 billion company.
Yeah.
So they were, they formed a short-lived non-profit to promote open information and open access, which eventually became going to be called the Center for the Public Domain. And they were a very big benefactor for the last number of years.
Now, were they involved in the Open Studios project that you also host on?
We met the Open Studios process group through the Tom Anderson's group.
You know. Okay. Yeah, because
go ahead.
You go ahead, Tom.
I love that we were all going to talk at the exact same time. That was funny. I was just going to ask a little bit about Open Studios and the because I want to say that this was mentioned to us some other place, but just about basically working with putting things in the public domain and kind of just trying to work. Is it something that's trying to undo the work that was done by the Sonny Bono law?
Well, lots of different people are working in that area.
Right.
Most prominently, the Creative Commons people are creating both an alternative to that, right, and then founders and others have been lawyers in two cases, that one that went to the Supreme Court, Eldridge versus Ashcroft, and one that didn't get quite that far, which is Brewster Kahle's one. I forget who the attorney general was in that one right off, but definitely those two. Right now, I think the way the courts have decided, you're pretty much need the courts won't be changing that law, because it's clearly the place of Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 8 that should be making those rules. They just have to make sure that the rules are conformant with the Constitution, and the way they've interpreted that so far is they want nothing to do with it. They want the Congress to do the work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, while we're talking about history, sort of move a little bit away from iBiblio specifically and just talk about what initially drew you to free software. And because you were doing all of this, you know, years before Creative Commons started, and there were some attempts to do to license, you know, free culture works before Creative Commons as well. And just sort of talk about that sort of, I don't know if we want to call it the dark ages or, I mean.
Well, some of the ages are quite dark, but yeah. Here's the thing. In the originally, all the money was in hardware and software was something you gave away or licensed at some cheaper price. This is before PCs. So when I started in computing, I had access to the IBM operating system and I could change it for IBM 360 computers.
Wow.
In fact, I did.
Really?
I did do that. Yes. I made changes so that when the 370 came along, which was meant to obsolesce or improve the 360 with some new commands that any program that used them would then break on the 360, I wrote one that would intercept that break, emulate what the command would have supposed to have done in software, and send it back to the program and have it just work.
Now,
so it's pretty deeply geeky, but it was a long time.
Hey, Paul, we've talked about Fortran on this show before because my dad did some Fortran programming. So,
okay, I'm happy to do that then. Okay, so what I did is took the first level interrupt handler and wrote an escape module that emulated that instead of treating them like errors, actually did the work that the hardware code would have done and hand it back as if it was all fine.
Now, why was it set up like that to begin with, that it would be executing such a thing if it could handle it?
The 360 assembler set, the assembly language reflects commands that work on the chip.
Oh, okay.
So when the chips got better in the 360 system, 370 system, then they extended and got rid of some of the programming problems that were inherent in the 360 so that you could, you know, programmers could be better and you could do more things more quickly and so forth. If you're working on a high-level language, you don't see that so much. It's all hidden from you.
So in a sense, were you actually making things backwards compatible?
Exactly.
Nice. All right. Which is a huge
one of those jobs that while you're doing it,
yeah,
you go, this is so cool. I'm doing this cool thing. And then you think about, really, we should be buying it, not running this this total piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
I should really just let it break and so that we could do the right thing and buy a new computer.
the way you're thinking about that.
But, you know, those thoughts coexisted in my mind, but I had a fun time doing it. And eventually, IBM and others started restricting access to that code.
Aww.
And most businesses buy that license. So IBM is not the only one. That's when AT&T started making a claim against Unix and trying to take that back and then license it in different ways and not allow code access, that the things that got Richard Stallman all excited in a good way.
Right.
And then really excited in a bad way as well. I mean, after the change.
I can't think of anything bad about Richard Stallman.
Well, no, I mean, just the aggravation. I mean, you know, the whole impetus between about, you know, starting GNU and stuff was a reaction to the changes.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. It was a reaction to two or three things that development of code, that programmers sharing code, which we used to do all the time. The sharing culture was very big. And so when you saw that disappearing and instead, you know, people going at each other and trying to steal people's code or hide people's code or build on people's code without giving it back, that kind of thing, that's really part of Richard's motivation, that loss, that change. And I think it was the right motivation, in fact.
So speaking of that, in that sort of sense, do you, with the way things are going today with Creative Commons and it also being added now to artistic works, that's the whole concept of what's going on, is just that people offering works to be altered, used, built upon, other such things.
Creative Commons is really a way of other people are already sharing software about various things, like, you know, download this, and if you like it, send me a beer from your hometown, or
right,
you know, beerware or shareware or postcardware or all of those kind of things were there, and people tried to apply that to other works too, whether it be music or mm-hmm. or works of art or other kind of things. There was a project that was where one of many kind of things you see now, but would people would redesign a tarot, and then the next week everybody would redesign the tarot deck again. And so there was sort of a giant archive of those, and that's not an unusual kind of thing. You know, it goes back to the French idea of exquisite corpse, where poets write a poem, each one only seeing the line that went before, but no others.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it was, well, when artists started doing this, and I like that you brought poetry into it, do you think it was kind of a thing where it's like, duh, you know, when you saw it, it's like, you've been doing this for years and fighting for it and kind of creating what this license was?
Well, a lot of artists understood it, but there's a confusion, you know, between really what how ownership works, because the law likes to think that it was, you know, created, whatever created means, mm-hmm. Independently in some sort of way. And then other people wanted to make a claim. In the U.S., particularly in the late 19th and very early 20th century, patent grabs were a tremendous business, and a lot of people made a lot of money by not licensing their new innovations, or licensing such a high price that it kept out any competition and that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. There's a pretty good book, which I'm going to now forget the name of, that's about the Wright brothers' attempt to leverage everything. And then Siva Vivekananthan's first book, it largely deals with Mark Twain's attempts to get copyright law extended, just like Bono finally did.
Really?
Yeah. So Twain was a very big, it should, you know, once I create it, it should be alive forever. And when you read
it's a good thing that never happened.
Might be. Yeah, not yet anyway. You can only be forever minus one day. So these kind of grabs are not new, just as artists sharing or mimicking others' works are not new. I mean, one of my, if you go to the Isabel Gardner Museum in Boston, there's a Titian copying, you know, another classical work right there, you know, but there's maybe 100 between them, but people liked it and there was only one, so why not just copy it? And many artists learned to draw or paint by copying. So used to, if you went through the Louvre, less so now, you would see people there trying to learn to paint, like the Mona Lisa or whatever. So that's how you learn, you know, just the same kind of thing. So now the licensing, when online sharing happened, people were trying to mimic the software licenses because that's, you know, what we knew. And also many of the people who are creating cultural artifacts that you're talking about were also coders, largely, or people that lived on the net and kind of understood that culture already, you know, as a different way than which artists did. They understood as a more collaborative culture already from their code sharing.
So just so we have some framework, you know, when you're talking about the licensing that, that you've done and being a coder, now when you release works, I guess probably, I mean, poetry some, blog post for sure. What sort of is your preferred license, or does it change depending on the work?
Well, I use everybody gets attribution. One of the first things we found out in Creative Commons is there were something like five choices: attribution, profit, not for profit, you know, alteration, or you can modify it or not modify it, and follow along, which means, you know, if you take it and modify it, then you have to be bound by the same license as this. And nobody chose to anonymous. Everybody wanted to be attributed. Mm-hmm. So now all Creative Commons licenses are attribution.
Well, there's still CC0, right?
Yeah, but nobody chooses it. Nobody chooses it.
That's very true.
So what we know is people do have an ego in their work and their contribution, and that's also true in free software. Is you know, there's sometimes the people who helped page is bigger than the code itself, and some of the little helping parts. So now, rolling back to this, is my preferred is it depends on the work. So generally, I try to give away as many rights as possible, but restrict attribution and follow along as are the main two. Now, if it's a poem, I'll generally make it not also that you can't modify it, because, you know, I don't want my poem modified that much. But you could certainly quote it, or you could add, if you really wanted to do that, you could write me and say that, but. And I would probably grant it in most cases. I think that's also true of musicians. For example, Roger McGuinn, folk den, he has a couple of hundred songs he started maybe 12 years ago in giving away free music on the internet. I mean, his were mostly FTP downloads originally, and now it's a tremendous blog of a couple of hundred American folk songs.
Wow.
And all of those are, you know, available for listening or downloading, and all of them are have a little bit of text and a picture that Roger likes, and a little story about how he heard it or what he thinks about it, and the tablature and so forth. And he says, you know, if people ask me to sample it, I would, you know, think about how they were doing it. But I just, he has his not for profit and attribution, and same as it is, which is no derivatives, or that's no mod. So, you know, you couldn't take the song and do anything with it without asking him.
Now, one thing that's been interesting, and I've never really thought about it, but John Spriggs, who we interviewed last week, because it hadn't come out yet, he mentioned to us that a lot of people, and I've noticed this since he mentioned it, a lot of people will put like a BYNC tag or BY no derivatives tags, but they won't put the share alike on there. And so once you've taken it from that site and put it on your site, you can relicense it however you want.
I think that's bad reading of the law and the license. That's not true.
Why would people not do share alike?
Really, the follow along, what you call the share alike or follow along license, it really only makes sense on the if you allow derivatives.
Well, that's what I thought, but
it doesn't make any sense otherwise legally. I mean, you could. The other is you still have that work. I mean, and so you can hand the work to somebody else, but unless you modify it, you can't claim any kind of ownership or remove that license, really. So the reason they do it mostly is because, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it might make you feel better and you might get all your bases covered, but I think you would, to the extent that you can prevail in these things, you can prevail. I mean, you know, and your remedy – That is what you can ask the courts to give you if somebody has been a bad boy, would be less in any case, unless you register the work. Yes, registration is the only way you get like a serious remedy.
Yep. And we've talked about that a little. Well, we did talk about that for sure, Tom, because that was, you weren't aware that you got copyright without registration.
Right. Yeah, I was very.
Oh, yes, in 1976.
Okay. So it wasn't something that's been for a long time, but I just remember when somebody brought that up, I didn't realize that it was that simple. I mean, for some reason, I just remember the old standard where, and I learned this from it, probably not the right person to say I learned this from, but it was a old school record company guy. Basically, he gave me the trick of what you do is you put down whatever it is you're licensing in a letter and then mail it to yourself and then just never open it. And that's how you copyright yourself. And that was the way I was taught.
But there is, you establish the date of creation. So that's an old thing. That is a very old school way to do it.
Right.
And that doesn't count as registration, by the way. That only establishes that you were the owner at that date. In case somebody were to make, exact replica, it would show that you had done it first.
Okay.
And cheaper than registration, but that doesn't count as registration.
And it's also a neat magic trick if that ever comes up. You can go, well, I did it this day, and then you open it, ta-da, and then there it is written down.
Well, you could.
So now you can just post stuff on the internet.
You can find it on archive.org. people have one case, have asserted their rights based on archive stuff and failed. They didn't have to go to court. I mean, the idea is to not go to court.
Right.
But get some sort of settlement or get things fixed, before you have to go through all that expense. Mm-hmm. But if you have something that's, you think is really valuable, then you need to register it. Go through the registration process. It's just that most of the things we do aren't.
And I guess one of those questions we like to ask everybody that we have on here, this being, kind of a Creative Commons music based show, is we like to know what kind of bands and artists, CC or otherwise, they don't have to be Creative Commons artists, but we'd just like to know what kind of music are you into?
But bonus points for CC artists.
Yes.
What am I listening to? Bonus points for CC artists. Well, so that means I can say Jonathan Colton easily, because any geek who's not listening to Joko is missing out on stuff aimed directly at us. Anybody who can sing about zombies and Mandelbrot, my favorite song is his ode to Bono Mandelbrot. And so Jonathan Colton, or also known as Joko, and in fact, he did a fundraiser for Creative Commons. So I got a lot of his music through there. And you could not only get all of his songs, but you could also get every track broken down.
Oh.
So you. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, wait a minute. This is that guy? Okay, I think I know who you're talking about. I've been to his site, and
John Coltrane. Yeah.
Okay. I was hearing the name, but I keep wanting to hear John Coltrane.
No.
Yeah, I do, and he does have it all broken down. Yeah, that's really cool. I found that pretty inspiring.
So you can build all kinds of stuff, and all that CC'd, mm-hmm. by the way. So I should get. Then he raised money for Creative Commons. Girl Talk. Of course, the latest Girl Talk, which you can download for free, and I think is CC'd, is pretty wonderful. You can download it as individual sections or as an hour plus of creatively remixed, highly sampled music. That one's pretty good. I'm listening to Roger McGuinn's Folk Den, which are CC'd, and a new song every month there. The most recent is a very early pirate song, which may or may not go back to the 16th century. It's a ballad that goes way back about three brothers in Mary, Scotland. One of them, they couldn't stay there, and so one had to leave to seek his fortune and become a robber on the sea.
Of course. Isn't that the way it always is?
Yeah, yeah. Henry Martin, who was probably Henry Barton.
But Barton or Martin?
Yes.
With a B or an M?
The song goes by both names.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Everybody thinks pretty much the Rogers version is Henry Martin because he learned it from Joan Baez.
Mm-hmm.
But the and that Henry Barton might be the guy who originally did it. That talk about changes. M's and B's and P's mm-hmm. are very changeable because they're in the same part of your mouth. So if you're a poet, that's an important thing to know.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, that's also the way that you can, those are interchangeable for ventriloquists, not to take away from the fact that you were just talking about poets. But,
yeah, exactly the same, for the same reason. It's right. Formed in the same way your mouth.
Yeah. So where do you like to go to find new music when you're looking for it?
Well, the new music other than those ones that pop up actually come from my 18-year-old son.
Oh.
So who thinks it's important, and he's right, that I not only know all kinds of music that I sort of missed the first time around, Joy Division, New Order, and Bad Lieutenant, that stream, but also people that reflect that sound, like the Wombats, who are a current UK band that's really good, or the Editors, who have one of the best lines I've ever heard. Nothing so sad as smokers outside of hospital doors.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even care. It's a really, it's a pretty wonderful song, and I can't get those, that it's called Smokers Outside Hospital Doors, by the way.
Okay.
And that is not Creative Commons.
Right. I like that your 18-year-old...
It was released for free digital download.
Oh, okay.
In 2007. And then you could buy it on CD and after that. And So there you are. Did it all kinds of
ways. Well, and I like the fact that your 18-year-old is also... listening to stuff like Joy Division and those bands, because those were some pretty kick-ass bands.
Yeah, he's followed the whole train of them. You know, Joy Division became New Order,
mm-hmm.
became Electronic, became Bad Lieutenant.
Right.
So yeah. That's the whole thing. He runs a radio show, too.
But, oh, really? On iBiblio?
Yes. You know, it's this... their station does stream on the net, and we do stream it, but it's a low-power FM station.
Oh, cool.
Carbora, WCOM, and he and some friends started in junior high doing a show, and they're still doing it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
He does it last away at school, but his buddies do it, and they play all the kind of things they like. So it can, you know, some people are into like 60s American rock and roll, and some of them are into something symphonic, and some of them are into this sort of, you know, sounds that came out of Manchester, and so it's because for them, you know, it's except for the people that are putting out music now, it's all sort of just music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If it's from the 80s or the 60s, it's just as far back.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with our Madison low power FM station?
I don't get it here.
Well,
right?
Slow power. Well, no, I was asking Tom. But
I was thinking the same thing you were, Paul. I was like, how's he going to know?
They stream it on the net. No, I don't think they do. Anyway,
you can get WSUM, however.
Right, WSUM.
COM.
Oh, COM. Oh, I thought because here we have one called WSUM.
This one is called WCOM.
Oh,
that's
cool.
Isn't that the college station?
That is the college one, yes. No, he's talking to me again.
Yeah. I know the college one in Chapel Hill is WXYC. I was there for 7 years. I got that one down. So.
That is the first streaming radio station on the internet.
That's right.
Indeed.
It was a question.
So how do you perceive Creative Commons use in schools and other such things since, you know, iBiblio, you know, putting books out there and everything?
Well, actually, we didn't really talk about that. We didn't really get that far into the story of iBiblio before we sort of sketch off. Do you want to talk about sort of the other things that you do, Paul, briefly?
You mean in my life or in iBiblio?
Well, I mean, if your life is pertinent to Creative Commons music, then that would be fine. But I meant specifically at, you know, the School of Information at SEALS and in J School.
Okay, so those are two, you know, two really different groups with two really different attitudes about where Creative Commons needs to go. So the SEALS people, since they're librarians, are very keen on Creative Commons largely, you know, because our job is to get distribute knowledge as widely as possible. In the School of Journalism, where we have many creators, there, while people are interested in it, particularly the people who are interested in media law and others, are really doing it, are, of course, keen on it. It's harder for people who are negatively impacted by the flurry of amateurism and sharing, say, like press photographers, who you know made a pretty good living off of that, and the press part is going down, and their side thing of you know, selling pictures is a little harder. You know, there were people who would shoot your wedding and then keep the negatives.
Right.
you would have to buy prints from them that only they could make. This is a pretty good business if you can get that kind of control and that kind of bargain. But now, pretty much, you know, everybody wants it digital. They want to distribute it to all their friends, and they're going to pay once. So there are people that feel that pain of, you know, things changing, and most all those people are now doing multimedia production and design and really fine stuff that, you know, you would pay for the same as, you know, if you get really serious about your Drupal or WordPress site, you might actually shell out for a skin or a custom design. So there is, but you can get by on what's free. So what's free actually builds a market for these people in a lot of ways, but and they've come into grips with that. That we do work with making a lot of UNC's stuff, but particularly in the beginning out of the libraries, they're available. And now the libraries projects themselves, through Documenting the American South, through the Southern Historical Collection, and through the Carolina Digital Library and Archives, have really stepped up. But for several years, we really did all that work for them to get them going, and now they have a tremendous collection, one of the largest, and I think the largest collection of slave narratives in the world. And there's a big movement for people before, after, and even during the Civil War in America to write their experiences of being enslaved. And they're the enslavers also have their diaries and stuff there, so you can sort of see the disconnect between those two visions of life. That's, you know, all available on free too. I think they do exert some rights,
yeah,
because that the idea there is, but you know, you don't want somebody taking a slave diary and injecting other stuff into their rewriting.
Yeah, that's almost the epitome of messing with something, isn't it? I mean, like taking it, right, and saying, "Boy, exactly. I sure do love this slavery," you know.
Well, we actually had a phone call. We had one of our earlier complaints was some guy in Arizona. We got two letters of complaint from Arizona, from the same city, basically, some guy and his secretary, who were complaining that they knew that a lot of slave people were happy to be enslaved, and we don't didn't, they didn't know why they couldn't find any happy slave narratives in the collection.
Oh, wow.
So how did they know that? Did they have happy slaves in Arizona?
There are many things that blow your mind as the world gets wide, and somehow people like to think that enslaved people wish they were back, and when you talk to people in Russia, they say there are people that wish they were under authoritarian regime again because it all worked. We'll probably be hearing something similar to that about Egypt. There is an imagination that you can just find people out there who will he'll say what you want them to say, and then you can project that on many larger numbers. But the educational value of access, the interesting thing about this is these slave narratives were originally brought together by a guy who's specialist in slave narratives, who said, I just want to make, these are rare books that people need to see, so this kind of studying this kind of work can go on.
And
when he started, he wrote down all the names of all the known slave narratives, and they made a project to find those and digitize them. Well, in the process of doing that, they nearly doubled the collection because people kept turning up others that were on no scholars' list.
Oh, cool.
Wow. The other interesting thing is when we designed it really. The idea, the target audience were scholars like the scholar who did that discovery. So it would be scholars and graduate students, probably. As it turns out, they're the third largest group of users. The second largest group is K-12 people who, need that access and are assigned by their teachers to actually read something written by someone at that period. But the largest group are genealogists. As it turns out, they're the largest thing doing group of people doing anything historical, but also African-American genealogy is easier than you might think. We have a large database of Afro-Louisiana stuff. All the material there is built on public records, and the reason they're such great documentation on African Americans is they were taxed as property. So anybody who was born, anybody who died, anybody who was bought or sold, anybody who was freed, and they didn't have a high mobility. So you can find these people. And so you can find your relatives. I mean, I'm not saying that any of that that it came out of anything good, but it's an interesting turn.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at the way things are today, like you made a comment earlier about Egypt, and when people look back at it and all that kind of stuff, with the internet and with the amount of information that people have access to, instead of it just being like, oh, well, here's the book, right? And someone goes, well, what's this book say? The book says they asked if they could have their internet turned off for a while because they were tired of it. With the amount of information that can come from everywhere, it's going to be like, well, this one thing says that and everything else over here says something else. And that's what's so great about the way the internet is. And it's kind of the way that you guys started out, in the sense that we want to have this all digitized so everybody can have access to it. And now,
absolutely,
yeah, and now everybody's doing that. So, kind of, you were very much a forerunner in this whole concept of just viewable information in a time where going full circle with this conversation, where there was only a couple of places on the internet where you could go to find things. So that's all really cool. I feel like that's you guys are to blame for this, for all this information.
Well, there are a lot of us out there thinking the same thing and doing the same thing. And so that's all pretty cool. So speaking of collaboratively owned public companies that are the Green Bay Packers, just one.
I know. My phone just told me that.
As you know, their ownership is nobody – has any amount of, has a very large amount at stake, because you know, they don't have a single owner or anything like that. They're, but they're a very broadly owned corporation,
indeed,
with a foundation. So they're, I won't say that they're open source, but if you're a fan, you can actually own the own part of the Packers, but you can't own much of any other.
Well, no, I'd like to know who all the you know, memorabilia and everything that's being made for it is going to then. Like, how do I get a piece of that?
It goes to the goes to the Green Bay Packer Foundation.
Oh. Well, it doesn't just go to them.
No, it goes to the stockholders.
Well, and it also goes to the NFL proper. They actually split.
Oh yeah, they do take the top, and there is a split between all teams.
Hmm. Yeah, but let's not get too much into NFL collective bargaining and such. But it's funny that you brought that up, because actually one of the things that I want to ask both of you about, since it was timely, is if you saw the opening, the national anthem, and also the halftime show, and what your thoughts on that were. Not Creative Commons, but both music. So I thought, hey, we'll talk.
I didn't see either of it. Probably right, really can't comment, but my favorite comment was over the halftime show was, is this really what Kiss looks like without its makeup on?
That was good. I actually thought they looked like the Village People. That was my initial thought. If the guy with the mohawk had like not had a shirt on, then definitely. Yeah. But Christina Aguilera butchered the national anthem.
Maybe she and John Roberts can get along, because, as you know, he butchered the swearing in. Yeah.
Anyway, I just, since we got talking about the Super Bowl, I just wanted to throw that in there.
Think she'll get a do-over the way that Roberts did?
Yeah, I don't know if they'll invite her back next year, but. They might. I don't know.
I doubt it.
Sorry to take us down that rat hole, but that was the very first thing that I had written on our questions. We just
talk about Christina.
No, that's not exactly what it said, but this is what it says exactly. Super Bowl music stuff, .. somewhere, .. not necessarily first, ..
Okay, well, I guess you've achieved that.
I did. So,
..
Yeah, exactly. we should probably, I guess, wrap this up a little bit, start to, because it's getting, I guess, on the late side over there in North Kakalaki.
It's about 10:39.
Yeah. So basically, who are some other people that you think we should interview? You know, what are people that you think would be great discussion pieces for Creative Commons music?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would look for people who do Creative Commons music specifically and ask them. If you could get an interview with Joko or Roger even, that would be really nice. You know, and there are a number of other people out there. I don't know if you're going to have a hard time with Curl Talk right now, and Joko's, all those guys tour. But yeah. I would... take a look at that, and at Greg DeKonisberg, who used to be at Red Hat, is doing some educational stuff right now, and he was involved with open source music and music remix and stuff while he was at Red Hat, and I think Greg may still be, is still certainly has in touch with people who are doing that kind of thing. And the Creative Commons itself hosts a remix community, which I'm suddenly going to blank on the name of, where people can just share, come together as a community, and they kind of know each other, and CC Mixter.
Okay, that's what it was. Yeah, I was
right.
There.
Definitely talk to the CC Mixter people. And there are a couple of people there that really, you know, kind of run the show collaboratively, that are really good people, and would be fun to talk to. And there's one guy in particular who uses, what is his name? Nine Stones or One Stone? Or I'll think of it in a minute. but he's really, really good in sort of the spirit of one of their editors that helps, you know, pick things and really make things work. So CC Mixter, definitely.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why I've never thought about asking them.
And yeah, basically, when you said Girl Talk too, it's like, why have we never tried to? Everybody else seems to be interviewing Girl Talk somehow. How could, you know, we should give it a try.
Right, you guys need to get hold of him. And I think Joko has been in the New York Times Magazine.
Yeah. No, exactly. Those are all great examples of people we should talk to. I'm glad that you mentioned
those. One of the reasons, Tom, that we haven't is because neither one of us is really into electronic music or maybe sampling. I mean, you know, that's...
It's not really he uses electronic, but he's really a singer-songwriter.
Oh, yeah. No, I was talking more about Girl Talk.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, the girl isn't... all electronically generated, like electronica so much. But it is remixed. It's, DJ Spooky.
Yeah.
Gets his work away and has done benefits for Creative Commons.
Okay.
And he's, you know, his real name's Paul Miller, but Spooky is really a good guy. And, you know, his Rebirth of a Nation is a really good use of copyright-free stuff, his video remix.
Hey, Paul, if you were a DJ, what would your DJ name be?
I think I looked one of those up all the time, but that's one I'm going to take a pass on. I'm not.
All right. Then you would just be like one of the DJs that just uses his name. You'd just be DJ Paul Jones.
Paul Jones is, there's enough Paul Joneses out there making music that I would be in really good company.
Right.
What is that movie where the guy he becomes elected because he has the same name as the guy that just died?
Oh, right. It's not Dave.
Right. I want to say Dave too. Dave. That's the first thing I thought of.
No, it's a different one.
You're not thinking of the Prince and the Pauper, are you? No, that's they look alike.
This is like a... Yeah, I don't remember. I don't even remember what the election was for. It was like a senator or something. It wasn't president, but it was, maybe it was even like mayor. You know, some sort of position where some people care, but a lot of people don't. Yeah, I don't remember. No, but anyway, that made me think of that. You could use your name for fame and fortune, and get a tour and play guitar. Paul Jones.
Well, Paul Jones is, you know, very famous for being the bassist for Led Zeppelin.
Right.
Yep.
Then there is another Paul Jones who was the lead singer in Manfred Mann.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Then he left. Nobody noticed. They hired somebody who looked just like him. And he started a solo career, and he's now has a blues show on BBC.
Oh, cool.
It's actually not terrible. It's pretty good. Oh. And he tours with the Manfreds. Everybody, a lot of the Manfred Mann band over time all got together and has a place called the Manfreds because the only guy who won't join them is Manfred Mann.
Funny. That's kind of just like, that almost sounds like the exact same story of the band that did Born to be Wild.
Steppenwolf?
Yeah, Steppenwolf. Yeah, like the singer will not rejoin the band, and they tour without him, and he ended up actually suing the band for using the name because he wasn't in the band. So that it was like a really vicious behind the music on VH1.
Oh, well, wait a minute. That. It looks like it's all better.
Really?
I'm looking at it now. It's called, the website is called John Kay and Steppenwolf.
Oh, I bet you that's how they made a compromise. Got his name
and
in there.
He's listed and he might own the name.
Right.
He might have. And
I think he did own the name.
If you've ever been to steppenwolf.com, you'll notice this website has a new look and a new feel.
Huh. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that they worked it out. It's good to close the show with a warm fuzzy.
He crushed them.
Yeah, or maybe he got rid of the rest of the band and we just don't recognize them.
I don't. I guess I have to consult the highest possible authority.
Your son?
Wikipedia.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe since he was the one that was showing you all the music, that would be the one you'd have to go by and go, are these the right guys?
Right. You know, they're Canadian.
Yes, that I did know, which is unfortunate because they, I want to say that they always get credit for being American, and with the whole coining the phrase heavy metal.
He's lived in Franklin, Tennessee since 1990, but here's the wild one. He was actually Lithuanian.
No. Really?
He was born in Tilst, which was then Germany, but after World War, in 1944, which quickly became Lithuania. Then they moved to Canada.
Huh.
So this is really incredible.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yes, I recommend his little biography here.
Okay.
That he is pretty completely wild, and they all moved to California when they became Steppenwolf and did it out of there. But yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, everybody will have to go check out the Steppenwolf site and learn some history.
There you are. And he's colorblind on top of it.
Of course he
Despite
is.
Despite this, he's an avid videographer. I think his PR person might have written it.
Maybe. I don't know if he would have shared that much information, but, I think the PR person might have done such a thing. Well, Paul.
There you are.
We want to thank you for coming on the show today talking with us.
I mean, Tom, we got to ask two more questions.
Oh, we do. What do you got for me?
And these are ones Paul will want to answer, I think.
Where can you send me money?
Oh, yes.
That's one of them.
That is one.
Basically, is how do people get involved with iBiblio? Or to yourself.
Okay. If you go to iBiblio.org, iBiblio.org, you'll see right there on the page a way to give to iBiblio, and we like it if people give, and it's tax deductible because we're part of the University of North Carolina and a 501c3 under that, and you can help us by clicking on the give button and help contribute. And I'm looking for it. Oh, I think, there it is. It's called Donate.
Yeah.
We changed the name because it makes more difference, more sense. Hmm. So you can donate, and you can also, if you want, propose a site that you would like for us to host.
So is there any other ways for people to help out? I don't know what sorts of things that you might need. Is monetary donations basically the easiest and best way to do that?
The good thing about money is we can use that to hire student helpers. So iBiblio only has one full-time employee as a sysadmin, and half of my time, because I'm also being a college professor, and then we get some support from the university, and most of that money goes to support students. So you can help students work through college by contributing to us.
Fantastic. And then the only other question we've got is if there's anything else that you want to say, advertise for, etc.
I'm in fine shape. I think that if people help out organizations like iBiblio, like the Creative Commons, and like the EFF, that it will help the world be a better place and in line with exactly the same kind of things that you guys are promoting.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right, Tom, you have my permission. Permission.
Okay, good. Thank you, Doug. This is a give and take we got going here, and I like that. all right, well, Paul, thank you very much for coming on. And everyone, that's Paul from iBiblio.org. And go visit the site, learn lots of stuff, learn lots of history, and just search the archives. I mean, I've been clicking around from here to there as we've been talking, and a lot of cool stuff on there. So thanks for joining us today, Paul.
My pleasure.
Great. And
see you guys later.
Yep, we'll see you next time on another Music Manumit at musicmanumit.com. Thank you very much.